Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Stephen L. Kent. Rogue Clown. With performances by Elliot Dash, Gregory Gorton, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, Christopher Sheeran, James Lewis, David Coyne, Alexander Strain, Anastasia Wilson, Joe Brack, Danny Gavigan, Michael Glenn, Bradley Smith, Stephen Carpenter, Nick DePinto, Patrick Bussing, Tim Getman, Dexter Hamlet, Eric Messner, Jeff Allen, Evan Casey, Scott McCormick, Johan Detweiler, Tony Nah, Terrence Azelford, Colleen Delaney, and Nanette Saval. Book 2, Rogue Clone. Earth date, 2512 AD. The battle facing mankind involved either two sides or four sides, depending on how you interpreted it. On the one hand, you had the Unified Authority, the ever-evolving successor to the old United States. The UA colonized the six arms of the Milky Way, creating a cosmopolitan society that superseded race and ethnicity. The galactic territories became a true melting pot as 180 new worlds opened up over the next 400 years. The Unified Authority accomplished all of that expansion off the back of an almost all-clone military. By the beginning of the 22nd century, UA clone labs began churning out over 100,000 cloned soldiers per year. The first real challenge to the Unified Authority's hold on the galaxy came in the year 2468, when a scientific expedition exploring the inner curve of the Norma arm vanished. Afraid that they had located a hostile race, the UA Senate authorized the construction of a super fleet of battleships, the Galactic Central Fleet. Senator Morgan Atkins, the most powerful politician of his time, oversaw the creation of the fleet and traveled with it on its first patrol of the Norma arm. Neither Atkins nor the fleet returned from that first patrol. These were desperate times, but a few well-placed politicians had a plan of their own. Working with the UA Navy, they manufactured a breed of specially designed clones called Liberators, which they sent into the Galactic Eye, the spot in the center of the galaxy where the six arms merge. Once they entered the Galactic Eye, the Liberators discovered that Atkins and a large group of followers were behind the disappearances. The Liberators caught him entirely off guard. They overwhelmed the Renegade base, but Morgan Atkins and his followers escaped in their stolen fleet. Sometime during the next 3 years, colonies of religious fanatics calling themselves Morgan Atkins Believers began appearing throughout the galaxy. As the 180 established worlds became more self-sufficient, the Mogat movement gained converts. A census taken in 2498 AD found approximately 5 million Morgan Atkins Believers. According to the 2508 census, more than 200 million people identified themselves as Mogats. In 2510, four of the Galactic Arms declared independence from the Unified Authority and the Civil War began. The Cygnus, Perseus, Norma, and Scutum Crux Arms formed an organization called the Confederate Arms Treaty Organization. Only the Orion Arm, Earth's home arm, and the Sagittarius Arm remained loyal to the Unified Authority. The Morgan Atkins Believers and the Confederate Arms formed an unsteady alliance. The Confederate Arms had an enormous population and large armies, but no fleet to move troops and defend planets. The Mogats had the Galactic Central Fleet, but they lacked the manpower to pilot their ships. A third partner was suspected of joining the Mogat Confederate Alliance, the Japanese people of Ezzer-Cree. As the Civil War began, the government of Ezzer-Cree came into conflict with the Unified Authority. When the Marines invaded Ezzer-Cree, the Mogat colonists who had settled on that planet fought a guerrilla campaign. Our invasion turned into an occupation, and the Japanese population vanished from the planet. No one knew what happened to them. Then the war broke out. The Confederate Arms and Mogats launched their insurrection. According to our best intelligence, the Japanese population of Ezzer-Cree signed on with them. Even with the Japanese on their side, the Mogats and Confederate arms did not seem to pose much of a threat. Earth date, March 1st, 2512 AD. City, Safe Harbor. Planet, New Columbia. Galactic position, Orion Arm.
You look like a...
I look a lot like an army clone. I hear that a lot.
The boy looked stunned. He was neither a policeman nor a guard, just an usher in a movie house.
I'm a lot like them. The Pentagon used my grandfather's DNA to make those clones.
No shit.
A smile formed on his face. Of the six arms of the Milky Way galaxy, four had recently declared independence from the Unified Authority, the Earth government. The Orion arm, Earth's home arm, remained loyal to the Republic. But this planet, New Columbia, was suspect. The New Columbian government swore allegiance to the Unified Authority, but its government was filled with politicians who openly sympathized with the Confederate arms.
Yeah, you might say half the army and I are cousins. For the record, army clones are about 4 inches shorter than me and a lot wider around the shoulders.
Yeah, I knew something was different.
The boy looked at my ticket.
Oh, wow. You're going to the battle for Little Man. Lots of clones in that flick. Third holotorium on the right.
I went down to the holotorium and entered through the double doors. The battle for Little Man had already begun. It was a war movie recounting a recent battle in which a regiment of UA Marines was massacred on a planet near the edge of the galaxy. Of the 2,300 Marines sent on that mission, only 7 survived. On the screen, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, barrel-chested Hollywood stud played Lieutenant Wason Harris, the highest-ranking survivor of the Little Man campaign. As I took my seat, 6 enlisted men let themselves into Harris's quarters.
What will happen down there, Lieutenant Harris?
I don't know, Lee. It's gonna be tough. It's going to be dangerous. But we are the Unified Authority Marines. We don't back down from a fight.
But if we die...
You listen here, Marine. Don't worry about death. We're here fighting for the Republic. The Republic needs us. The people need us, as they've never needed us before.
I slumped in my seat. This movie was supposed to be authentic, with real combat footage taken from the actual battle. Maybe the battle scenes would be more realistic, but this portrayal of military clones was painfully propagandistic. As Harris finished his soliloquy about defending the Republic, the door at the back of the holotorium opened.
Hello, Harris. Let's talk.
Can it wait? I want to see how this turns out.
You know how it turns out. You were there.
Not at this battle, I wasn't. The invasion of Little Man that I saw didn't look anything like this. We got pinned down on the beach. The Navy had to nuke those Mogat bunkers just to get us off the sand.
Huh. Is that so? They make these movies look so real.
The man behind me seemed content to watch the rest of the movie. As the movie neared the conclusion, the screen cut to a scene showing 6 of the survivors saluting Hollywood Harris as he boarded a transport to Earth. Those 6 would attend officer training in Australia. They were the first clones ever to become officers in the Unified Authority Marines. As the transport took off, the screen faded to black. The words, "Lieutenant Wason Harris died 5 months after the Battle of Little Man while defending the Unified Authority outpost on Ravenwood," appeared in the center of the screen.
That's heartbreaking, Harris. It's specking heartbreaking. I've seen this show a couple of times now, and that part always gets to me. Know what I mean? Okay, so you weren't a lieutenant, and you didn't lead the charge on Little Man? Yeah, and you didn't die on Ravenwood. Should I believe the rest of that stuff?
The man who had sat behind me in the theater was Jimmy Callahan, a New Columbian thug who hoped he could make a name for himself by playing the local espionage game. Callahan and 2 buddies had taken me to an outdoor cafe, and we took a table on a terrace overlooking a trendy part of town.
You know, Harris, it just goes to show you can't trust anyone anymore. I mean, here's a movie that's supposed to make people feel all warm and patriotic. And what do you tell me? It's a pack of lies. Nothing happened the way they said it did.
Now that I had met him in person, Callahan struck me as a lightweight trying to make a name for himself. He had a menacing presence. I gave him that much. His muscular chest and shoulders filled his t-shirt, and his bulging arms stretched the fabric of its sleeves. But Callahan had a soft, manicured, almost pansified face. His cheeks were pudgy, and his skin was smooth. He marbled his brown hair with blonde streaks.
From what I hear, you've got information on some pretty big fish?
Big fish? Yeah, I suppose you could call him Big Fish.
How do we know we can trust you?
I'm good for it.
Callahan turned to smile at the two men sitting behind him. They returned his smile. These were his bodyguards, I supposed, though I sensed the relationship went beyond mere protection. Probably brothers.
I suppose the reason you're gonna trust me is that I have what you want. The only reason we're talking is I got information and you've got money. An alert guy like me with an unlimited supply of information? I figure you can take a chance on me. As long as your friends in DC have a bottomless wallet and I've got good information, Harris, it's the world's greatest romance. So, are we gonna do business today? I hope you didn't come all this way just to see yourself in the movies, you know what I mean?
You've given us some good stuff so far. Nothing great, but good enough. A couple of low-level operatives.
You hear that, boys? I've given them some good stuff so far. Are all clones this tight-lipped, or is that just your personality? Tell you what, Harris. I'm just like this restaurant. I've got a menu, know what I mean? You want low-level operatives, I'll give them to you. They're worth what, $1,000 a pop? So let's talk Big Fish. What's Crowley worth? What do I get for a Big Fish like Amos Crowley?
Amos Crowley was someone in whom I took a personal interest. A former general in the UA Army, Crowley nearly killed me twice. Once when he sent a band of terrorists to attack a backwater Marine base, and once when he sent an inept assassin to even the score for the role I played in saving the base.
Crowley? He might be worth 100 grand, if your information was good.
100 grand. I like that. The math adds up. Small fish, $1,000. Crowley is like 100 times more important, so he's worth 100 times more dough. I like that. How about Yoshi Yamashiro? Is he worth something?
I know several parties who would be interested.
Yamashiro was the former governor of Ezra Cree. I had nothing against the man personally, but the Department of Justice took a dimmer view of him.
And what do I get for Warren A?
Warren A was Warren Atkins. The At in MOGAT was short for Atkins, named after Warren Atkins' famous father, Morgan Atkins.
Ambitious. Leading us to Atkins would make you a millionaire. Of course, everything would depend on the quality of your information.
So let's talk about the biggest prize, Harris. What if I get you the biggest deal of them all? What do I get if I lead you to the Galactic Central Fleet?
The Galactic Central Fleet was a very large fleet of antique naval ships. The MOGATs had already used GCF ships in two minor attacks, one of them being the Battle at Little Man.
As I recall, there is a $10 million bounty for anyone who can lead us to the fleet.
You hear that, boys? I could wind up rich. You don't trust me, Harris, do you? How about I give you a sample, just this one time?
You offering a freebie?
You must be mistaking me for the halfway house down the street. I don't do charity. Know what I mean? How much do I get for Billy the Butcher?
William Patel?
Patel was a harbinger of death, a Confederate arms spy master blamed for terrorist attacks on civilian targets. He had a high enough price on his head. Whenever intelligence reviewed satellite footage of terrorist bombings, Patel's face appeared somewhere in the feed.
Last I heard, he was worth $25,000 for a tip, and maybe twice that for a capture.
That's so. How about if he's practically gift-wrapped? See that red Paragon?
Callahan pointed to a car parked far away down the street.
That's Patel's car.
Sure. And the dump truck up the street belongs to General Crowley. Saw him drive it there myself.
Oh, you don't believe me.
Sure, I believe you. Patel drives a Paragon. Nice car. I always took him as more of an armored tank man myself.
You don't think much of me, do you, Harris?
Is there any reason why I should believe that car belongs to Patel?
Is that reason enough for you?
Callahan pointed toward the street. There, stepping out of a delicatessen, was William Patel. He wore a black leather trench coat that swept along the sidewalk. He was tall and wiry, with black hair and dark glasses hiding his eyes.
I did some business with Billy this week. My boys have been following him ever since he came to Safe Harbor. He comes here for coffee. He goes to the same damn stores every day. Loves this friggin' block. Hey, maybe he's visiting his sweetie. You know what I mean?
Taking only a quick glance at the stalled traffic, Patel skipped from the sidewalk to the road and wove his way through the cars. He was still in the middle of the traffic when he turned, looked in our direction, and peered over his shades. Having paused only for a quick glance, Patel walked past his expensive burnt orange paragon and vanished around the corner. I jumped from my seat.
Where are you going, Harris? You don't think you can catch him from here?
I grabbed Callahan by his collar with my left hand and clipped the first of his bodyguards with my right. The second goon stepped in my way. I brought the edge of my foot down on the instep of his leg, pressing hard against his knee.
Harris, you speck! What the hell do you think you're doing?
Muscles or no muscles, the man followed without a fight. I tugged and he came running.
Real tough boys you've got there, Callahan.
Pausing for less than a second, I caught a glimpse of flames bursting out of a distant storefront.
What the hell?
I pushed him forward through the door that led from the outdoor terrace into the restaurant. I shoved the stupefied Jimmy Callahan through the swinging doors and into the kitchen. The big room was empty. Steam and froth boiled out of the 5-gallon pots along the stove.
What are you doing?
The entire building seemed to leap from its foundation and slide backward. A large metal table in the center of the kitchen flew in the air and landed upside down.
God almighty! My boys! Tommy! Eddie!
I stood up and pulled him to his feet. I spun him around and launched him face first through the service entrance at the back of the kitchen. We entered a long service corridor that ran behind all of the buildings.
Harris! What the speck happened? Where are my boys?
They're dead, Jimmy. Everyone in that restaurant is dead. Maybe one day they will make a movie about the way the terrorist blew up this restaurant, and they can make you the hero. Wouldn't that be a great idea for a movie? Know what I mean?
Jimmy and I made our way to the streets. With their facades blown off, the buildings along the block looked desecrated and bare. The delicatessen, the building Patel visited right before the explosions, had drooped like a tent in a storm. The explosions reduced several buildings to nothing more than mounds of brick and debris.
God almighty.
I pointed to the restaurant we were just in, nothing more than a mound of rubble.
Your pals are under there.
Jimmy nodded and said nothing. Fire engines and ambulances appeared at the end of the block where William Patel's burnt orange paragon still sat parked. The emergency vehicles could get no closer. The street was choked with cars. As the firemen dug through the wreckage, the medics started sorting victims. Freight helicopters swooped in from overhead.
You've seen this before?
I've seen worse than this.
Callahan's dark eyes narrowed as he began to comprehend what had happened. He ran to the ruins of the terrace and dug into the debris.
Tommy!
He found something and tugged at it until he unearthed the remains of a chair. There was no river of blood along the streets, just dirty bodies, some alive, some dead. Jimmy Callahan might find an arm or a leg as he pulled up chunks of brick and plaster.
Wait, are you gonna help me?
No.
There are people under here!
Callahan stood there as stiff and lifeless as a waxwork dummy. He held his hand palm up as if he were cupping water. Somewhere along the way, I got the feeling that Eddie and Tommy, the bodyguards, meant more to Callahan than hired muscle, but I didn't know what was going on between them. Callahan looked like he was going into shock as he looked at the pile of concrete and metal.
Come on. This pile isn't going to unearth itself.
How did you know? How did you know this would happen?
I knew because Billy Patel is a galactic-class terrorist, and you're nothing but a two-bit punk.
A punk? What do you mean?
Means that there was no way you and your two-bit operation was going to sell out a big player like Billy the Butcher without him knowing it. He knew we were watching him. He knew you were watching him all along. When he ditched his car and turned to look back at us, he knew exactly where to look. We were right where he wanted us, and he couldn't resist a quick look back just to gloat. He must have figured you were too stupid to guess what he was up to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's spec, Harris.
You asked.
So why did you pull me out? You would have made it out more easily on your own.
Look at this.
I was standing beside a long, heavy beam that looked like it might have been made out of white marble. I found leaves from the hedge that had run around the edge of the terrace. One of the firemen walked over, thinking I had possibly found some survivors.
You found something?
We were just leaving the building when the bombs went off. There were people, right about here.
I squatted and brushed away a layer of dust, then picked up a smashed branch with 5 teardrop-shaped leaves.
Send a team, full gear. We might have something.
Now that they had located a promising spot, the firemen ushered Jimmy Callahan and me away, as they did serious excavation.
You think anyone is alive down there?
Now that the helicopters had cleared the streets, fire engines and ambulances could drive right up to the buildings. The firemen placed tripods with spotlights around the dig.
I've never seen anyone pulled out alive.
The rescue team's ultrasonic cannon reduced rock and glass to powder. The ultrasonic cannon fired sound waves that passed through liquid, air, and wood. You could fire it into a pond without bothering the fish, but the rocks in the pond would disintegrate. It did not hurt people. The firemen used the cannon to clear a 3-foot-deep crevice under the beam. Two rescuers lugged a stiff, wide-bore hose into the hole. The hose was almost a full yard in diameter, with some kind of cage in its opening.
What is that?
I'd never seen anything like it and did not answer.
Stand clear!
The other rescue workers backed away from the site. Suddenly, the rubble beneath that gigantic hose compressed into a powder that was finer than sand. The hose sucked the dust up. A fireman with a tow cord strung around his waist walked up to the crevice left by the hose. He tied off the cord, then rappelled out of sight. Two more firemen lowered themselves into the hole. Someone handed a stretcher down to them as a fire engine and an ambulance drew just a few feet away. The fire engine extended a ladder over the hole and dropped a winch to the fireman. Then the rope tightened, and the winch raised the stretcher from the hole. Two medics received that stretcher. They detached the cord from the stretcher and pulled the woman into the back of their ambulance. In less than 1 minute, they loaded her, sealed up their rig, and sped away into the darkness. Another ambulance immediately filled the vacancy. The rescue workers found 76 people in that one area. 62 were alive. Tommy and Eddie were alive. As the explosions had come closer, they had crawled under a table and made it out virtually untouched. Tommy had a badly broken jaw. Eddie's knee was shattered. But those injuries were my doing. The explosion barely scratched them. I was glad Jimmy Callahan's boys were alive. Callahan was going to need all the help he could get. He had some powerful enemies. Considering the devastation that I had just seen, I doubted that silent Tommy and limping Eddie could protect Callahan from much of anything. How to describe Ray Freeman? Freeman stood over 7 feet tall. His hands were so large that he could bury your face in his palm and plug your ears with his thumb and little finger. Every inch of him was sinew, no gawky limbs on Freeman. He had a large head, heavily muscled arms, and shoulders so wide that he had to move sideways through narrow doors. In the galactic melting pot of the frontier, race meant nothing. Terms like African, Caucasian, and Oriental were obsolete. Freeman's skin was such a dark shade of brown that it almost looked charcoal. Looking into Ray Freeman's far-set eyes was like staring down the muzzle of a double-barreled shotgun. Utterly ruthless, he was the most intimidating man in the galaxy. He was my partner. 2 years earlier, when I limped out of the ambush on Ravenwood Station barely alive, Ray Freeman rescued me. He placed my helmet beside the remains of Corporal Arland Marston, staging my death, then carried me out of Ravenwood. Instead of wearing dog tags, UA Marines wore helmets with virtual identifiers. Now Freeman and I were in business together, freelance bounty hunters.
I hear there was some action on New Columbia.
Yeah, I was in the middle of it. You seeing much?
Freeman was on Providence, an evacuated planet in the Cygnus arm, one of the Renegade arms. We were speaking over the media link. He was using a communications console with a camera so I could see him.
Have a look.
Freeman stepped away from the camera to give me a panoramic view of downtown Jasper, the capital city of Providence. The streets were completely empty. The only cars were parked along the curb. No children playing, no pedestrians. Everyone had fled the city.
What time is it over there?
Nighttime.
Do the streetlights turn on automatically?
Yes.
So is anybody left in the city?
Looters. Even the gorillas are gone. Is it safe for you to be on New Columbia?
I don't know. Is it safe for you to be on Providence?
No one knows I'm here.
Fair enough. My flight leaves in a couple of hours. Maybe you should do the same. Get out of Jasper before the troops arrive.
Freeman responded with his get real glare, a deadpan expression, a slight narrowing of the eyes, and a barely perceptible shrug of the shoulders.
I met a guy who says he can find Crowley.
I'm listening.
Guy's name is Jimmy Callahan. He's a local who bags supplies and runs deals for the Mogats.
Did he say that before or after the bombs went off?
About the same time. Callahan and I were negotiating.
You think the bombs were aimed at you?
At him. It was Billy the Butcher, one of Callahan's clients.
Where is Callahan now? We need to put him someplace safe and sit on him.
He's in the brig at Fort Washington along with two of his bodyguards.
You stashed him at the Marine? case?
Admiral Kleiber sent for me. I figure the Marines can keep him till I can come back.
I'd better go. That might be the people I came to see.
I drove my rental car to the commercial spaceport. There would be no paperwork. The car registered its own return, measured its fuel level, reported its own condition, and then issued an electronic receipt to Arlen Marston, the missing-in-action Marine corporal who received my helmet on Ravenwood. Since Marston and I were both clones, and one clone is supposedly indistinguishable from the next, the personal identifiers in our helmets were the only way the military could tell us apart. That was the theory. In truth, I was not identical to Marston. He and I came from different batches. My form of clones, the Liberators, had a dark history. Most people believed that the Senate had outlawed my kind. It wasn't true, by the way. They only banned us from entering the Orion arm, the arm I was currently in. I passed the queue for baggage. During my years in the military, I learned to live light and travel lighter. I spent 4 days in Safe Harbor, 2 more days than I expected. Everything I brought fit in a small briefcase that I could carry on my lap. From New Columbia, I would fly to Mars, the galaxy's biggest spaceport. Once on Mars, I would either receive my next assignment or I would find a hotel room and rest until my next job arrived. I didn't care which. I went to the gate to wait for my flight, which would leave in another 3 hours. I cherished short breaks like this. It was the long ones that drove me crazy. I put on my MediaLink shades. On this particular day, I decided to read. My favorite reading was ethical philosophy. At the time, I was reading the complete works of Spinoza. Spinoza argued that men could not feel love, desire, or passion without already having a germ of that emotion within them. It was an interesting concept that was especially true of military clones. Our loyalty was programmed into us. We loved the government that made us. Even when we realized the government hated our kind, we still loved it. Even when we hated the government back, we remained loyal. Clones were also programmed to think they were natural born. Your average soldier clone did not know he was cloned and programmed to love nothing but their country. They just thought of themselves as patriotic citizens. Was Spinoza so depressing, or was it just my over-applied interpretation of his work? I looked around the gate. This particular flight was a business flight. Men in suits sat scanning the media link or writing memos. Women in suits did the same. A young mother tried to busy 2 small children by reading to them. I had no love, desire, or passion for any of these people. They were natural born. I was synthetic. A rare synthetic. I was a clone who knew he was a clone. My model was designed before the Senate added a death reflex to its military clones to prevent them from rebelling against their makers. The rest of my kind were created at a time when the Republic was under siege. The Galactic Central Fleet, an armada of warships, had vanished. As a last resort, the military created battalions of Liberator clones and sent them to the Galactic Eye to kill whatever unknown enemy was there. The battle ended quickly. The problem was that having created a living, breathing superweapon, the Unified Authority did not know what to do with it. When the generals sent Liberators to settle smaller battles and domestic problems, they did not like the result. Liberators were sent to stop a riot on Albatross Island, a penal planet in the Perseus Arm. The Liberators killed the prisoners and then turned on the guards and the hostages. With the exception of a few prison workers, the Liberators killed everyone on the planet. In the end, Congress banned Liberator clones from the Orion Belt and let attrition thin them out. I stepped off the assembly line in 2490. By that time, only 4 Liberators still existed. 3 were wild and bloodthirsty, caring only about their own survival. 1 was religious and completely loyal to his UA creators. He was my mentor. To this day, I do not know whether to admire or despise him. The flight took off smoothly, rising through the sky. When we were about 200 miles outside of New Columbia, the blue and white atmosphere ended and turned into the blackness of space. We picked up speed and traveled another 800 miles to the broadcast network in a couple of minutes, a painfully slow pace. I reclined my seat and stretched out for the short ride. We were traveling 240 trillion miles to Mars. The flight would take just over an hour, and I needed the rest. I turned my head toward the porthole beside my chair and watched the tent shields form over the glass, dimming out stars and planets under a blanket of inky blackness. We would soon reach the broadcast network. I could not see the discs through the shields, but I knew what was coming. 1,000 miles outside of Safe Harbor, our space jet slowed to a crawl as it approached the two gigantic elliptical disks that formed the New Columbian Sector's broadcast station. The disks were approximately 1 mile across and reflected everything around them like giant mirrors. The space jet did not enter the disks. As it approached, jagged tendrils of electricity stretched out of the glossy face of the sending disk.
Prepare for broadcast.
And then the first 10,000 light-year jump was over. We had traveled 60 trillion miles in less than 1 second. We traveled the remaining 180 trillion miles in the next few minutes, the time it took to emerge from a receiving disk and glide to the broadcast disk beside it. The transfers took approximately 30 seconds, and we made 4 of them. I did not like going to Mars. I came here because it was the most crowded spot in the galaxy and the best jumping point for meeting Admiral Kleiber. The traffic around this planet was so congested that no one paid undue attention when ships took off and headed out to space, and Kleiber's pilots could meet me here and smuggle me away without attracting attention.
You ready to go, Marston?
The man stood in an open doorway. The pilot knew my real name. He also knew better than to refer to me as Wason in public.
Sure.
The pilot walked quickly and caught up with me. Dressed in a long leather jacket and khaki pants, he wore the traditional uniform of civilian pilots. His short black hair was slicked back, and a pair of dark aviator glasses poked out of his shirt pocket. He was not a civilian. He was an officer in the Navy. We left the shopping arcade and entered a food court.
You are the hot topic on the ship these days. Is it true?
Is what true?
Were you in Safe Harbor when the bombs went off?
Where'd you hear that?
One of my friends heard Kleiber say you were there.
Well, if Admiral Kleiber says I was there, I must have been there.
We crossed the food court and entered an unmarked door. This led us into a narrow service hall that seemed to stretch for miles.
So were you there when the bombs went off?
Yeah, I was there. I helped dig out a few of the survivors.
The service hall led us out to the tarmac. We crossed the tarmac and climbed into a Johnston R-27.
You strapped in?
I fitted the last of the safety harness across my chest, a useless gesture. Any accident in this little craft would end in death.
This is Johnston R-27-0449,
rectal anus penal 5, requesting permission to taxi. Again, this is Johnston 0449 RAP5, requesting permission.
Roger, Johnston R-27. You are cleared to taxi.
Aren't there regulations about what you can say on the air?
To the tower? Controllers love it when I talk dirty. It's their supervisors who get pissed, and that's all right. They can't touch me. I have military clearance, and they're just civilians.
The commuter runway was a mile-long tunnel with several airlocks. A crewman towed us to the first airlock using a cart. When he reached the far wall of the airlock, the crewman detached our tow cable, gave us a quick wave, and drove back to the terminal. The runway behind us vanished as the 30-foot door closed behind us, sealing in the spaceport's manufactured atmosphere. The wall in front of us was thick and heavy, the color of oxidized iron. After 2 minutes, a seam showed in the center of this great metal barrier. This time we rolled forward under our own power and stopped just shy of a final barrier, an electroshield. It was a force field designed to stop intruders and deflect attacks. The electroshield could dampen particle beams and laser attacks, and anything solid that hit the shield would be instantly fried. I could see the surface of Mars ahead through the electroshield's translucent white aurora.
Do they know you're self-broadcasting?
It's sort of hard to hide something as big as an anomaly. They track us the moment we leave Mars. We're the only ship that flies towards Saturn instead of Earth or the broadcast network. That kind of thing gets all kinds of attention these days.
I suppose.
The pilot throttled forward and the plane took off through the electroshield. Huge as the Mars spaceport building was when seen from the inside, it became a mere speck as we pulled away from the planet. The only broadcast disks in the Sol system, Earth's solar system, hovered a few hundred miles above the spaceport. Normally, spacecraft either flew up to the disks or headed toward Earth, the only populated planet in the solar system. We, however, flew in the opposite direction. We headed out toward space, toward Saturn, and traveled more than 100,000 miles. Only the most powerful tracking systems, like the ones on Mars, would detect what happened next. Sitting out in space, we glided as the contraption in the back of our craft came to life. The glass around our cockpit became as black as space. It was opaque, but not dark enough to block out the electrical storm caused by our broadcast engine. Lightning danced across the edges of the Johnston R-27. I could see its squirming outline through the tinting.
Welcome to Welcome to the Perseus arm.
Still in Perseus? I thought they would have moved the ship by now. We are at war.
Why move? No one knows we're here. We're protected from both sides.
The Doctrinaire was so incredibly large that its size created an anomaly. Viewing the ship alone in space, you could not estimate its size. At first glance, she looked like any other fighter carrier. The same wedge-shaped body, the same beige hull and light gray underbelly. In the vast panorama of space, size and distance became blurred. Seeing the Doctrinaire floating beside a Perseus-class fighter carrier, you would think they were identical ships, and that the Doctrinaire was closer to you because she was so much larger than the other. The hull of the Doctrinaire filled the view from our cockpit long before we reached its landing bay. The ship was shaped like a bat, its wingspans measuring 2 miles wide, and its hull was about 1.3 miles in length. The pilot flew the Johnston toward Bay 3. We slowed to a mere hover, and the pilot used thruster engines to guide us into place in one of the docking bays.
Well, Corporal Marston, it's been a pleasure flying with you on Doctrinaire Space Lines. Fly with us again sometime.
The Doctrinaire had several banks of elevators, but only the central bank reached the bridge. As I entered one of those elevators, a security computer scanned and identified me. The doors closed behind me. Moments later, they opened onto the bridge of the Doctrinaire. It was a sweeping deck, manned by dozens of officers. Three officers came in my direction. The man on the right was a captain, a heady rank in the UA Navy. He was young, stout, and very attentive. He looked like the kind of aggressive officer who runs a tight ship and accomplishes his mission at any cost. The man on the left was a rear admiral. He had a single star in his collar. He was an older officer whose casual smile and soft eyes gave the impression of patience. The man in the center was Fleet Admiral Bryce Kleiber, possibly the most powerful man in the entire Republic. Kleiber was an accomplished naval officer. He rose through the ranks by answering every challenge. With the exception of Bryce Kleiber, no one had worn the fifth star of a fleet admiral for 40 years.
Marston, I thought I left orders for you to meet me in my quarters. Just as well. Corporal, this is Rear Admiral Haverson and Captain Johansson.
I saluted. They saluted back. Kleiber looked over at the Rear Admiral.
Admiral Haverson, have you met Corporal Marston?
Corporal, I don't believe we've met. Rear Admiral Haverson.
Haverson looked to be in his late 50s, an officer nearing retirement. Haverson looked like a youngster beside old man Kleiber, however, a painfully skinny man who looked like he could have been one of the slaves forced into building the pyramids of Egypt.
Marston here is retired from active duty. I reactivate him on occasion. He's got a knack for security. Perhaps we can take this up again later this evening. I have some business to take care of with the corporal.
Haverson and Johansson saluted and walked off to continue their discussion.
What do you think, Harris?
She looks ready to run.
Yeah, more or less. It's not the equipment that worries me. I worry more about the men at her helm. You get a limited selection of officers with top secret projects. My crew is chosen for security clearance, not battle experience. If I wanted a ship full of military police and intelligence officers, this would be the ideal crew.
You worked with Haverson and Scootum Crux.
Tom Haverson does what he can. I like Haverson. What did you think of Johansson?
Not especially friendly. He doesn't make a great first impression.
Let's head down to my quarters.
Yes, sir.
We entered the elevator.
What happened on New Columbia?
Mogat terrorists happened.
Anyone I've heard of?
William Patel.
Billy the Butcher? Are you sure it was him?
I saw him myself, sir. Callahan, the informant you sent me to meet, fingered him. Callahan thought he could earn himself some credibility and a nice reward by handing him over to us.
Patel was wise to him.
Have you met Callahan? He figured he could pinch both sides of the loaf. He sold Patel supplies and us information. It takes a subtle hand to play both sides off like that. Subtlety is not one of Callahan's stronger suits.
We entered the Admiral's suite, which included his quarters, a large office, and his war room.
So you don't think the bombs were meant for you?
Not a chance.
What tipped you off to the bombs?
We were sitting on this balcony overlooking the street, and out comes Patel, practically right on cue. He's too far away to nab, but somehow he knows where we are sitting, and he looks up at us. I mean, he's 100 yards away, and he looks right at us. I didn't trust Callahan. He struck me as a punk, a small brain with a big mouth. So when Patel looks right at us, I figure he knows exactly what Callahan is up to. The only question I had was if we could make it out in time.
The big question is, who tipped Patel off? Do you have any theories?
Somebody on your staff.
Interesting that you would say that. Of course, you realize that, parked as we are so far from the broadcast network, we don't have communications with the outside world. In order to get a message to Patel, our spy would need to travel, broadcast to another location. Given that, do you still think the leak came from here?
Yes, sir. Whoever leaked the information traveled.
Oh, I have something for you.
Kleiber opened a closet hidden in the wall beside his desk.
A friend sent this to me. He didn't know anything about you, of course, but I think you'll appreciate this.
When Kleiber turned back toward me, he held out a small book with tan leather binding that looked parched and old. The leather had gone stiff with age and drying. The words, "Personal Journal of Father David Sanjean," were emblazoned in dark brown letters that stood out against the dust-colored leather.
A friend in the Vatican sent this to me. Most of it is of no interest. It's the journal of an archbishop, but there's a small section concerning a mutual acquaintance of ours. I want you to have it.
I took the old book, and it seemed to fall open of its own accord. The book had a 5-inch strip of blue velvet ribbon sewed into its binding for a bookmark. Parts of that ribbon had turned nearly black with age. I noted the date, April 10th, 2494, on the open page.
That is the only entry of interest. It goes on for a few pages. I'd like to revisit your impression of Captain Johansson.
You think Johansson is a spy?
Oh, I know he's a spy. The question is for whom?
A spy. Do you think he's a MOGAT?
I'm guessing he's worse. I think he works for Admiral Wong.
Admiral Kleiber had a long-standing feud with Che Huang, the Secretary of the Navy, and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Huang? That would be bad. We're 1,000 light years from the nearest planet. Dump him in space and say he had an accident.
It's too late for that. Whatever he's looking for, I assume he's already found it.
That doesn't mean he's been able to report everything he's found.
Whatever information he was after, he transmitted it the first time we sent him out. The safest thing to do with Johansson right now is to keep him on board the Doctrinaire. That way we can observe him.
Assuming he doesn't have any friends on board.
I hope he does. We're keeping an eye on him.
If he's Huang's boy, you're in for a fight in the Senate. If Huang hears about the Doctrinaire, he's going to ask for control of the project. He'll probably put Wonder Boy in command of the ship.
Wonder Boy, a.k.a. Rear Admiral Robert Thurston, was Che Huang's protege, the brilliant young officer who replaced Kleiber as the admiral of the Scutum Crux fleet.
I'm meeting with Huang and the Joint Chiefs next week at the Golan Dry Docks for a top-secret briefing. I would very much like to return from that conclave alive.
I spent the night on the Doctrinaire, sleeping in one of the staterooms that Admiral Kleiber reserved for visiting dignitaries. Stripping to my general-issue briefs and top, I took the book Kleiber gave me and climbed into my rack. I opened the journal to the section marked by the thin strip of ribbon. As I looked at the handwritten entry, I realized that Admiral Kleiber had been wrong. The man described in this journal was more of a mentor than a friend. The passage was about Tabor Shannon, whom I had met while serving on the Kamehameha, Kleiber's old flagship.
From the Journal of Father David Sanjean, Archbishop and Chief Administrator of Saint Germain. Entry, Earth date June 4th, 2483. I received an urgent message from the spaceport security this morning. When I called to look into the matter, the captain asked me to watch a feed from his security monitor. They had detained a Marine named Tabor Shannon. I only needed a moment to identify the problem.
Is that a Liberator? Haven't they been banned?
Liberators are not allowed in the Orion arm. They can travel Cygnus freely. If you want my opinion, I think they should all be executed.
The captain told me that he checked with the UA consulate.
We don't have to let him on our planet. Should I send him away?
Do you know what he's doing here?
He says he is on a pilgrimage.
You must be joking.
No shit. No, Father. I'm sorry about that, Father.
I understand, my son. He is on a pilgrimage?
That's what he says.
I asked the captain if he would detain the man in question until I arrived. I thought that might be soon, but this was a Friday, a holy day, the Immaculate Heart of Mother Mary. I needed to attend a mass, and then I had a full day of meetings. The Liberator would have to wait until tomorrow. Entry, Earth date June 5th, 2483. I did not know how I would react to meeting a Liberator face to face. As a young priest, I served in the Albatross Island penal colony. I was there during the riots of 2472. A force of liberators came to the planet to stop the rioting. They put down the riot, all right. They also killed the prisoners and the guards and almost everybody on the planet. You cannot understand a lion until you have seen one devour its prey. I thought that all people were created in God's own image until I saw the liberators, demons who looked like men but who rejected all goodness. Once I witnessed the way the liberators fought and killed, I saw the wisdom of the Ecumenical Council's judgment. These monsters could not have had souls. I arrived in the spaceport before lunch and found an office in which I could interview the liberator. His name was Tabor Shannon. I arranged for us to be alone. I was an old man now, and I had no time to fear devils, not even cloned ones. Three soldiers walked the prisoner into the room. "Leave us." The liberator sat in one of the seats I had arranged in the middle of the room. "I am Father Sanjin. I came to sit across from him. We were nearly knee-to-knee, just a foot or two separated us. You are Corporal Tabor Shannon?"
"That is correct, Father."
"I'm an old man, Corporal Shannon. I took my vows nearly 50 years ago. Would you like some sherry? We don't have many fine things on Saint Germain, but we do have a superb distillery. I personally oversaw the building of it. I've been in this mission from its start."
"No. Thank you."
"You'll want to try it before you leave."
"What is this about? Why have you detained me?"
"Mr. Shannon, this mission is nearly 20 years old. I have been the chief administrator and archbishop here for all of that time. Before coming here, I was a chaplain on the penal planet."
"Was it Albatross Island?"
"It was. You can imagine my feelings when I received a call alerting me that a liberator had arrived in our spaceport. You claim that you have come on a pilgrimage, is that correct?"
"It is, Father."
"You will forgive me if I find that hard to believe, Mr. Shannon. But you see, I watched 300 of your kind butcher prisoners, both rioting and innocent. Perhaps you were not involved in that
action."
"I was trying to decide whether to call it a slaughter or a massacre. I think a more appropriate word might be extermination. As best as I can remember it, 1,500 inmates rioted, and the Marines sent a battalion of liberator clones to restore order. That was 5 rioting inmates for each liberator. I should have thought that would have been enough blood to satisfy them."
"I wasn't there."
"When they finished killing rioters, they slaughtered prisoners who did not riot. And then they turned on the guards and the hostages. By that time, they weren't even using bullets anymore. They beat the men to death with their rifles. I helped reclaim the bodies of the victims, Mr. Shannon. It was the most terrible thing I had ever seen. That was the closest I ever came to renouncing my vows. When I saw what those liberators had done, I did not even believe that a just God would have allowed the creation of such monsters. A few weeks later, the Senate outlawed liberators. Is that not so?"
"They outlawed the manufacture of liberator clones."
"We don't, as a rule, receive many clones on this planet. Forgive me. I have been too straightforward. Are you sure you will not have that sherry?"
"Are you refusing me entry?"
"We Catholics like to believe that our church runs this planet, but the Unified Authority maintains an embassy just down the street from the Archdiocese. The UA runs this spaceport facility, as a matter of fact. That is not a symbiotic relationship. We do not welcome government intervention on our planet. They were without compassion, ravenous dogs lusting for blood. You will forgive me if I have been impolite
Mr. Shannon, but I see nothing even remotely redeeming about your kind. I once questioned the doctrine that clones have no souls. Having seen the work of liberators, I determined that the butchers who came to Albatross Island were soulless creatures. I saw nothing redeeming in them.
But if there be no virtue to take away, consequently, there can be no vice.
You've read St. Augustine. Impressive. But you've misquoted him. Augustine said, if there be no good to take away. He also said, it is impossible that there should be a harmless vice.
He did say that, didn't he?
The liberators who invaded Albatross Island did a lot of harm. I believe that their existence is a vice. It is a vice of the Unified Authority Government.
I never cared much for St. Augustine anyway. What about the secular philosophers? Friedrich Nietzsche said that no man has an eternal soul. If he was correct, that would put us all on equal ground. None of us would be alive by the Vatican's definition.
Quoting a philosopher who referred to himself as the Antichrist does not generally lead to a favorable impression in a Catholic colony. I suggest you restrict yourself to St. Augustine while you are here on St. Germain, Mr. Shannon. Better yet, I suggest you avoid discussing philosophy entirely. The people on this planet have strong opinions.
While I'm on St. Germain, are you allowing me to stay?
What is the object of your pilgrimage?
The same as any pilgrim. I seek truth. I want to know who I am and how I fit into the universe.
And you believe you can find those answers on our little planet?
I'm curious about Catholicism.
I can tell you where the Catholic Church stands when it comes to you and your place in the universe. The Catholic Church holds that you have no soul, and that you are an abomination.
And yet, I am created in God's own image.
Man was created in God's image.
And I was created in man's image.
I will allow you to visit our planet. And I hope the answers that you find here will not leave you perturbed.
March 13th. 2512 AD. Location, Golan Dry Docks. Galactic position, Norma Arm.
Starliner 810-2034, this is Dry Docks Traffic Control. Please come in.
Traffic Control, this is Starliner 810-2034.
Ahead of me, the Golan Dry Docks looked like a cross between bleached bones and a giant spider web. 8-mile pillars described the outside of the platform in lilting arches like the ribs of a gigantic skeleton. The dry docks housed over 800 cubic miles of space for building ships. Golan did not orbit a planet. It was a free-floating space station.
Starliner pilot, please identify yourself and prepare for a security scan.
This request did not worry me. Admiral Kleiber had picked me for this assignment. The head of Doctrinaire Security crafted my new identity and logged my clearance and flight plans while I was still on New Columbia. I flew a Johnston R-56 Starliner, a 20-seat luxury craft on loan to me from the Doctrinaire fleet.
Please state your identity.
Lieutenant Commander Jeff Brocious, UA Navy.
Lieutenant Commander Brocious, copy. Are there passengers aboard your flight?
No, sir.
Thank you, Starliner.
Traffic control was acting unusually polite, and I had a pretty good idea why. Security gave me the name Brocious because Admiral Alden Brocious, the officer in command of the Central Cygnus Fleet, was headed to the Golan Dry Docks for the summit. For all the men in the traffic tower knew, I was the Admiral's son or nephew.
Starliner R-56, we are under heightened security at this time. Please switch off all onboard controls. Our traffic computers will guide your ship into port.
Aye. The traffic tower took control of my ship the moment my hands left the panel. Lights turned on and off as traffic control accessed all of my instrumentation. They might discover that I had unusual equipment on board, but they would not know it was a broadcast engine unless they tracked me from millions of miles away. My ship slowed to a near standstill as it joined the queue waiting to enter the Phase 2 landing bays. Unlike the rest of the platform, Phase 2 of the Golan platform was totally enclosed. Leaning back in my seat, I took in the sights as my ship dropped into place. Inside, I could see the brightly lit landing area and the staging area that planes entered just before takeoff. Beyond that, so far away that it looked no bigger than my fist, was the half-mile-wide aperture for departing flights. Whether by computer or human talent, traffic control brought me in for a perfect landing. A runway technician towed me through the atmosphere locks and into the staging area. There would be no old-fashioned blast door on the ultra-modern Golan dry docks, no sir. On Golan, the locks were completely transparent electro shields. I grabbed my bags and climbed out of the Johnston. Two guards, armed with M27s, approached and saluted as I stepped onto the deck. I, wearing my Charlie service uniform and looking like a quintessential officer, saluted back.
Commander Brocious, may I take your bag?
Aye.
Please follow us, sir.
The soldiers led me to the security station, a well-lighted island in the otherwise dim light of this enormous spacecraft hangar. All I had to do was walk between the posts, an innocuous 10-foot archway made of beige-colored plastic. Terrorists and criminals feared the posts. They made supposedly extinct clones edgy as well. The post on the left side of the archway housed a device called the sprayer, which emitted a fine mist of oil and water and a sudden blast of air. The jam on the right was the receiver, a micron-filtered vacuum that drew in the air, the mist, and anything that the sprayer dislodged. There was no disguising your identity from the posts. You could wash, shower, and shave your entire body with a micron-bladed scalpel, and the gust from the left post would still find dandruff, flecks of skin, loose hair, lint, or sweat. A bank of computers analyzed every substance the right post drew in.
Commander Brocious?
The MP motioned toward the posts. I had to pass through security funnels like this one on every planet. The difference was, this was the Golan Dry Docks, a high-security facility. The computers would recognize that I was a liberator. But the men manning the computers were no more screening for liberators than they were screening for dinosaurs or dragons. As long as my identity cleared, my liberator DNA would not trigger an alarm. I stepped into the arch, my mind already focusing on what I would do once I left the security station. The Joint Chiefs had already arrived. Admiral Kleiber and the other field officers would arrive in another 2 hours. As soon as I left this station, I would make a preliminary sweep of the corridors just beyond the security station. Then I would move to Kleiber's quarters. If I worked quickly, I would finish an hour before he arrived. The post on my left blew out a millisecond-long burst of air. In the booth beside the posts, four soldiers sat beyond the glass playing poker. One had just turned over his hand. The others tossed their cards onto the table in disgust. Suddenly, the security station went on alert. Bright red warning lights flashed on and off over my head. Clear sheets of bulletproof plastic slid out of the walls, creating a bulletproof cell. By the time I realized what had happened, every soldier in the security station had drawn his gun and closed in around me. The MP holding my bag stepped to the glass and held up a piece of paper for me to read. It was a computer printout with my picture and bio on it.
Lieutenant Harris, we got a tip that you might stop by.